The meeting will come to order. Welcome. I was prepared to say good morning, but because usually this committee meets in the morning, but we've now shifted until the afternoon. My name is Rick Hansen. I serve as the chair for the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division. Our goal today is to do some introductions, adopt some rules, and then hear an update from the Department of Natural Resources. I apologize if I haven't connected with everybody yet. I've had a bit of a cold, so you might hear that. Hasn't everybody had a bit of a cold in the last week or two? So welcome to the committee. I represent Northern Dakota County, so the cities of South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, and Lilydale. And before we start with members, I'd like to have the excellent staff that we have here introduce themselves, both partisan and nonpartisan.
Hi, I'm Peter Strohmeyer. I'm the committee administrator.
I'm Brad Hegemeyer with the House Fiscal Analysis Department.
I'm Janelle Taylor with House Research.
Bob Eliff, also with House Research.
Amy Zipko, GOP Research.
Margaret Sadra, TFL Research.
Clay Short, Walter, Committee Legislative Assistant.
These are the folks that help make things work here, so I want to welcome them and thank them for being here. I also want to recognize the House pages, and I'm not sure if the pages are assigned to committee yet, but if you... So you're still floating, but could you introduce yourselves and where you're from? Welcome. With that, later in the introductions, we'll go a little bit over some of our accounts that we have. But I'd like to start with introductions. And Representative Fabian, if you would like to maybe introduce yourself and say a little bit about whatever you'd like.
Sure. I'm Dan Fabian, referred to today as Shorty. You can tell by the chair that I'm sitting in here. I'm the GOP lead on the committee, looking forward to what we're going to be doing this year. I represent the furthest northwest corner of the state, Roseau, Kitson, Marshall, and Pennington County. And we love the outdoors up there. Thanks.
Representative Dale Lewick, and represent Aiken County and most of rural Cowing County. We've got almost 90% of our pre-settlement wetlands still in place. Aiken County, for example, is well over 50% public land, and obviously about 50% wetlands. So we deal with a lot of environmental issues, and we've got a whole ton of little wastewater treatment plants, and we do a lot of other natural resource-based, you know, the economy is really based on natural resources, logging, and a little further north of us, mining and also tourism.
I'm Jason Rarick. I represent 11B. That's Pine and Kennebec County, right between the Twin Cities and Duluth. I was happy to serve on this committee when I was first elected. I unfortunately did not serve on it the last 2 years, but so happy to be back again.
That was the chair's discretion.
I'm Representative Ann New. I am referred to every day as Shorty. I represent most of Chisago County, which is just north of the Twin Cities, including lots of lakes, Taylor's Falls, Lindstrom, that area.
So I'm Josh Heintzman. My district is 10A. I have the Brainerd Lakes area, and on the weekend, our population quadruples or more. So there's a lot of folks coming into my district because of the recreational opportunities. Terrific place to represent.
I'm Steve Green. I represent District 2B, so the farthest southeast is probably around Park Rapids, Monaga area. From there I go quite a ways toward Fargo to Lake Park area and then north up just about to Highway 2. My district consists of farming, logging, resorts, and we have just a good diverse community. There's also industry there, so we have a big stake in this committee.
Representative Backer. We're just introducing ourselves.
Hi, I'm Representative Backer. I live on the Hump Bump Tip, Elbow Nose, on the western part of Minnesota. James Genius, representing South Central Minneapolis.
Holly Morrison, 33B, which is my community, but generally the South Lake Minnetonka area. My district has more water than land, actually.
I'm Mike Sundin from 11A that encompasses Carlton County, the bulk of it. I have a Native American reservation in my district. I have Jay Cook State Park in my district. I have a history of logging, ag, and recreation in the state. I'm a hunter, and if I'm not tied up in long-winded committee meetings, I enjoy fishing.
Peter Fisher, 43A. That'd be the communities of White Bear, Montemite, Birchwood, Wilderney, and Maplewood. The biggest thing we've got to keep an eye on in our area is water with White Bear Lake and what has happened over the years there.
Jamie Becker Finn, District 42B, which is Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, Gem Lake, and parts of Roseville and Shoreview. We have 14 lakes in my suburban district, which is not a lot if you're up north, but is kind of a lot for a suburban district. So thousands of hunters and anglers in my district, and I hunt, fish, and rice. So I got the trifecta.
I'm Rob Eklund. I represent District 3A, and my district is the far northeast corner of the state. So between Representative Fabian and I, we've got pretty much northern Minnesota covered. I represent Couchin County, Lake County, most of Lake County, all of Cook County, and northeast St. Louis County. And a couple little facts similar to Representative Lewick's. Couchin County is still 91% plus pre-settlement wetlands, and they have 63% public land. Cook County is at 93% public land, and also in my district is Voyageurs National Park and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, so we've got lots of issues to deal with.
My name is Steve Sandell. I represent District 53B, which is most of Woodbury. It's a growing suburban area, but we still have farmland. We have parks and playgrounds and water that we want to protect, and water that's been damaged and is vulnerable, and so we have plenty to talk about today.
Fooley from District 59A, which is North Minneapolis, and I also represent the city, the number one park system in the country, the Minneapolis Parks.
John Purcell, District 5A. The geography I usually say is the city of Bemidji and the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. Lots of lakes and woods. Chippewa National Forest is a good part of my district. Everybody comes there to be a tourist, or many do, I should say. And Representative Becker Finn comes up there to rice. She's a Leech Lake band member.
I'm Ann Claflin, the Vice Trans Committee. I'm from District 54A, which is South St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Newport, Gray Cloud Island, and St. Paul Park. At the Mississippi River runs right through the middle of my district, and we have suburban natural resources.
And I anticipate throughout the session there will be times when Representative Claflin will be chairing. So the gavel's right here, and I think she'll do a great job working on that. Just a little bit on rules and posting, and maybe Mr. Strohmeyer, if you could just mention how we're doing posting and what we've put on for the public to see.
Sure, Mr. Chair. We'll try to post the meeting materials right before the hearing so the public can have access to it as the meeting's happening. Obviously, with amendments, we'll post as soon as we can with the deadline and the rules, similar to past years, the way we've done amendments. That's it.
So the rules are in front of you, and they are the same rules that we've operated under, Representative Fabian, the last few years. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to expand a little bit on hearings and so forth, obviously there's been some discussions on the House floor about, you know, bills being referred to Ways and Means and then down to here and the possibility of them being sent someplace else with a memo. What assurances can you give me that the issues that are going to be before the committee that you post now this week for next, say, Tuesday or Thursday, I guess, are actually going to be heard then throughout the session?
Thank you, Representative Fabian. So as an example, we posted, I believe, today what will happen next Tuesday. So we're going above and beyond what the minimum is, and that's our goal with that. The fiscal chairs were just in a training on how the memo should be working, how things will go from Ways and Means to the divisions and then back up to the two Ways and Means. So there may be some bumps here right at the beginning, but my intent is to try to post it without any, in the absence of any other information, to try to post the information as soon as we can. And so that, for those of you who are going to be testifying and the agencies, if we can get the materials early so we can post them, if there's a slide presentation or if there's printed remarks, that would be helpful. And if we receive something during the meeting, we will try to post that as soon as possible after the meeting. With the memos by letter, we'll be posting that so that people can see which bills are coming to the committee that we have in our possession. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, my concern with regards to this new system is people that may want to testify who live where Representative Eklund and I do, which is up north. You know, it's one thing to live kind of close to the Capitol, but when you live 360 miles, it makes it very difficult. And, you know, to just give you a little perspective for people that don't know where Roseau is, when I get to Bemidji, well, actually, we consider Bemidji to be on the northern border of central Minnesota, okay? And when I get to Bemidji, that's for you, Representative Purcell. When I get to Bemidji, I go, only 130 miles to go basically straight north. So my concern is for people that may want to testify, making sure that the schedule that's posted on Thursday is actually the schedule that's going to be heard on Tuesday. So,
And Representative Fabian, as I mentioned, my goal is to try to post them even earlier than that. That may not be possible. I know that it's taking a little bit of time to get bills drafted for folks right now. I would like to be able to start considering some bills within the next couple weeks, but I think it's going to take a little time for introductions, for members to get signatures on bills and to get them introduced. So we're going to try to make sure we hear from the agencies, we hear from folks on issues in these next few days. So next Tuesday, we will be hearing about the impacts of the federal shutdown on the agencies. And I don't anticipate any bills being heard on Tuesday. So with that, does everybody have the rules in front of them? If we could get a motion to approve the rules.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd make a motion that this committee adopt the rules as presented.
Sundin moves. Is there any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Rules are adopted. Congratulations, that's the first motion we've done. Sounded unanimous, too. Mr. Strohmeyer, do we have anything else? So with that, I think we'll move into the expenditures of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources responding to the chronic wasting disease outbreak. I believe we have Mr. Meyer and Mr. Cornicelli, and when they come forward, maybe if they could just, we have new members of the committee, to talk a little bit on just the flow chart of where you are in the structure so folks have an idea of how you're representing and who you're representing within the agency.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources. And we will be providing a detailed organizational chart in the coming weeks as we get into our budget discussions so you can understand each division and how they interact together. So, as I said, I'm an assistant commissioner. My official duties, one of the major ones, is government relations activities. So I will be your main point of contact from the House and the Senate into the commissioner's office. I'll be providing you my contact information and meeting with you all very shortly here to talk about that. We have two other assistant commissioners and a deputy, two vacancies that are in the process of being filled right now. And then our divisions, you will get to know and love. We have seven different divisions, Fish and Wildlife being one of them, Ecological Water Resources, our Division of Enforcement, Division of Forestry, Division of Lands and Minerals, and our Operations Support Division, and Division of Parks and Trails. How can I forget them, right? Providing lasting memories to the natural resource recreation. without any, unless anybody has any questions, I will introduce Dr. Lou Cornicelli, who's within our Fish and Wildlife Division. And, Mr. Chairman, our presentation, just to provide a better depth of the fiscal impacts, Dr. Cornicelli is going to be talking about a little bit about CWD, the history of the disease, and our work and efforts since it has been identified and what we've done to date, focusing on the southern Minnesota harvest and activities that are going on right there. And then I do also have a handout to talk about the fiscal impacts to the Division of Fish and Wildlife of these activities that we maybe can talk about at the end of the presentation.
And Commissioner Meyer and Mr. Cornicelli, would you prefer that people ask you questions during it, or would you rather have them held to the end?
Mr. Chair, I have no preference. Whatever works best.
I think we'll allow questions during it if we can, just because there may be points that people have questions about. So just let me know, and we'll try to get you recognized. So with that, Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. As Mr. Meyer indicated, I'm going to give a bit of a history of chronic wasting disease in Minnesota and kind of key on the last couple, 3 years of our response. And as the chair indicated, feel free to interrupt me. It's not a problem at all. So what is CWD? For folks who don't know, it's a progressively it's a neurological disease. It slowly progresses in species that it affects. In this case, CWD is a cervid-specific disease. It's deer, elk, moose, reindeer. The agent belongs to a family of diseases called transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, and they're prion diseases. They're not proteins. They're not fungi. They're not viruses, and they fall into this family that of other diseases such as scrapie in sheep, mad cow in cattle, Creutzfeldt-Jakob in humans. So they're all in the same class of disease. They all have a little bit different mechanisms of spread. For chronic wasting disease, it's spread animal to animal, so urine, feces, saliva. One of the challenges we have with identification of this disease is that the symptoms don't manifest until very late in the disease stage. So it's anywhere from 12 to 36 months between onset of getting the disease to when you have symptoms, and up until the last few months, the animals look normal. If you look at the pictures, the deer in the upper right was killed in November 2016, and it had CWD. The deer in the lower right is a research animal, I think, in Colorado or Wyoming, and it also had the disease. They don't look like that in the lower right until the very last couple of months. They typically look like the deer in the upper right, just perfectly normal. So what are the characteristics? Again, like I indicated, it's a neurological disease, so dementia, incoordination, abnormal behavior. They lose body condition relatively rapidly, like I said, over the period of months. Since it's not a virus or a pathogen we're familiar with, there's no treatment or vaccine, and it's always fatal. Whether that deer dies from another cause or dies from the disease, it's always fatal. These prions persist in the environment for a very long period of time, up to more than 5-10 years. It depends on the research study you look at, the soil, but they do remain persistent for a very long period of time. They don't go through heat-thaw cycles. They don't denature with sunlight. Once they're on the ground or in a contaminated feed or something, they remain infectious for a long time. As I indicated a minute ago, incubation period is a year and a half to 3 years from when you're exposed to when you develop clinical symptoms. But what we also know is those animals start shedding those prions relatively quickly, usually within 30 or 60 days. So they pick up the disease, they start cycling it through their body, and they start shedding those prions long before they're symptomatic. There's no genetic immunity to the disease. There's some work on resistance and talk of resistance, but there's no immunity. And as of now, there's been no documented evidence that the disease affects humans or cattle. There's some research going on in Canada that hasn't been completed yet, and the CDC has recently changed their guidelines to say that you should not consume venison infected with prion diseases. So there are guidelines that we adhere to from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So kind of the basic characteristics.
Excuse me,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, I was wondering, I don't know when you put the slides together, but I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on the recent comments from Dr. Osterholm regarding potential spread to humans.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, yes, I've seen Dr. Osterholm's article, and I know him pretty well. Yeah, I mean, it's these diseases have an amazing ability to morph, and I think it's reasonable to take those precautions. You know, the science isn't there yet, but we also know that the science is always changing, and we know that prion diseases have morphed before. There's been some in Wyoming, Colorado, with Dr. Krieger, Dr. Miller, in those states who believe that CWD is basically a morph from scrapie, because the deer were put into a sheep facility, and then we had CWD. There's no empirical evidence, but that's the conventional wisdom from the folks that have been working on the disease since it was discovered. We also know, we've all heard about variant CJD related to consumption of BSE-infected beef in Europe. So these prions have done this before, so I certainly don't at all discount what Dr. Osterholm has to say. We await the science, basically.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we do have a study, though, that shows that it has passed to monkeys who ate infected meat. So if you could comment on that study a little bit.
Dr. Cortes.
Representative Hansen, Representative Becker-Finn. Correct. There's a study up in Canada that isn't finished yet and hasn't gone through peer review, and that's the one where they fed infected prion-infected meat to macaques. And saw clinical symptoms, but the paper's not done. It's not come out of peer review. So, if my memory serves me and the timelines are correct, that's pretty much when CDC came out with their revised guidelines to not consume prion-infected meat. And I think it's fair to say that all of us are waiting for that study, because I think it has huge ramifications for disease management and deer management. But since we're just kind of waiting for the results, like everyone else is, but I don't have any insider information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Could you provide the committee with the CDC guidance?
Mr. Chair, yes, I can do that.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Carnicelli, on these recent outbreaks, so the wild animals that are harvested are brought in the CWD areas to be tested. In our farms, is there a blood test or something that can be done on live animals to find out if there's positive testings at the deer or elk farms?
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently the only acceptable test is a post-mortem test using lymph nodes or OBEX, those tissues that accumulate prions. There's some research looking at live animal testing using rectal mucosa, but the sensitivity is not 100%. It's about 70%. It's not an acceptable test. With respect to animal movements, and it's a live animal test, so it's not a wild, really, it's not a test that's applicable in the wild. There's some research going on looking at different assays. There's a test called, and I'm not a microbiologist, so bear with me. There's a test called RT-Quick, where they're looking at amplifying blood and other fluids in the lab to try and detect prions in other fluids. There's been some work looking at, in Wisconsin, there was a paper published looking at natural and artificial mineral licks with saliva. So there's some laboratory testing that is being developed in live animals, and also rapid testing in other tissues besides OBEX and lymph node. But right now there's nothing that's been accepted as a gold standard for testing. Right now it's immunohistochemistry, IHC, is the confirmatory test on dead animals.
Thank you.
Yes. So why are we concerned about this? The disease is being found in a lot of states pretty more often than we would like. Most recently, there are cases found in northern Mississippi and southern Tennessee. Just last week, Dubuque County, Iowa. We had ours, and I'll talk about Houston County a month ago. So the disease is being found in more places. It's really what spawned our desire to ban the importation of all carcasses into Minnesota, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the disease is being found in more and more places, just kind of at all times of the year. So our concern is that, you know, it's now in 25 states or in three Canadian provinces. So we have real concerns about how this disease is moving on the landscape, both naturally and artificially. So, you know, we hear a lot of things about this disease, but the feeling of, I think, most, if not all, wildlife managers and those of us charged with managing our state's natural resources, that things are not okay with this disease. We know it's 100% fatal, and we often hear that, well, most deer don't live long enough to die from CWD, and that's true. The issue is, though, is that we know, based on research as close to us as Wisconsin, that an animal that's infected with the disease is more likely to die from some other cause because they have the disease. So in other words, carrying this prion predisposes you to mortality factors that you may not have otherwise. Wisconsin has shown, I think it was about 3 times mortality rates from positive versus not positive animals. We know that bucks are 3 times more likely to have the disease. That's based on their biology. Bucks move across the landscape. They contact multiple family groups of females. They're more likely to pick it up and then carry it someplace else. And you see that in every state where this disease is found, and even in our state, most of our radiated out animals are bucks.
Dr. Cornicelli, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, with regards to the bucks, is there an age category that is more likely to be CWD positive?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative Hansen, Representative Fabian, that's a really good question. And on the surface and on the whole, bucks are more likely to have the disease. And as they get older, they're even more likely to have the disease. And that's a function of their biology. The longer they live, the more they range, the more females they contact over their lives, so they have a greater chance of contacting another animal that's positive. So the prevalence goes up. The older you get, the higher likelihood of having the disease, yes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Dr. Cornicelli, did you say as bucks get older, they range further? Did I hear that correctly?
They do an initial movement when they're young, and then as they get older, you know, they're ranging in more areas, maybe not distance-wise. And, of course, the distance you go is dependent on the habitat you live in, so you can't really say that bucks always go 5 miles or always go 10 miles. It depends on the habitat complex. But the older they are, the more they'll move and the more contact they'll have with females.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, The flip side of that question is, how many years or months is that infected deer, particularly a buck, in leaving prions that can affect others or sharing them in any way? So if we know how many months they are, we can do some fairly easy multiplication and figure out how much is being spread at what pace, just given the number of deer that have been found in, is it Houston County or Fillmore?
Dr. Grossley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, it's one of the things we're looking at. You know, you have to, it's difficult to put a parameter estimate around what a potential infectivity rate is, because that's really dependent on percent of the animals infected, the complex of animals infected, how those animals move across the landscape. I'm going to get to it at the end, but we're doing a deer movement study, which is looking at the theoretical possibilities of prion spread based on how these animals move across the landscape. And then you're correct, you can build predictive models based on prevalence, based on how the population moves, to get an idea of what, you know, when will it show up in this county or that county based on, you know, but you need a lot of data. You need surveillance data. You need a lot of animals radio collar to know where they're going, because they all behave a little bit differently. Not everybody moves. Some move a lot over the course of the whole year. Some don't move at all. Some move only in the winter. So there's a lot of things that go on with a deer population over the course of a year.
Representative Wagenius.
I get the future predictive models, but I'm thinking about the deer that you have found just recently that have been affected. You know whether they're doe or buck, and you can give us some idea of how long they were out in the wild infected. So given that, information that we have now, can you give us some idea of what those animals
are spreading, or how far, or how much. I mean, we know a lot about what deer do, so help me out here.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative Wagenius, we do know a lot about what deer do, but we certainly don't know everything. It's very difficult to say that this deer that's infected, for one, until they become clinical, well, we never really know how long they've been infected, because they can manifest symptoms from 18 months to 3 years. So that's the time period. A deer that is CWD positive, there's high detection levels, low detection levels, but you can't definitively say this animal's been infected for a year or 2.5 years. When they're found dead, like we've seen in a few cases in our state, or if they're clinical, then you can infer that they've been infected for quite some time. But it's not really possible to say, how many animals did this positive deer contact? That's why we have to, build some predictive models based on what those animals do, deer densities, frequency of contacts, and, there's a lot of data that goes into building that stuff. And it's difficult to say with any reliability what an individual animal would do. We deal with population.
Representative Wagenius.
I've got to follow up one more time. But we do know how many deer you have found recently, and we do know a minimum number of months that they've been infected. And it does seem to me, and we know how far bucks go and we know how far doe go, it does seem to me that you can make some inferences there that will give us clues about how aggressive we need to be in dealing with this issue.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Representative Hansen, Representative Wagenius. Yeah, that's correct. When we found the disease in 2012, and I'll walk through kind of how we came about discovering our response, the fact that we found the disease in a relatively small area at first, it would indicate that it was a relatively recent infection, probably within the last 2 or 3 years. Because if the way we do surveillance, and I'll get into that, if the disease were on the landscape, but across three or four counties, we likely would have popped a positive here and a positive there. But we found positives in 2016 in one place only. So our belief and the data supports a recent infection. Now, how that infection spreads on the landscape is a function of whether or not you can eliminate it right off the bat, which clearly we haven't done, because we still see positives. And are new animals getting infected and then spreading the disease across the landscape, which is what we're starting to see. But I can fairly comfortably say we caught it early, because we're not seeing disease over a 25 square mile with a lot of animals. We're seeing disease over a 4x4 square mile area with animals shooting off, males shooting off. So I think you're correct, although it's difficult to exactly predict how long it's been here or what the rate of spread would be, which is why you see that aggressive response that we have in order to limit that spread. Dealing with wild animals, it's challenging, as you know.
Representative Heinzman and then Representative Purcell. Were you done, Representative Wagenius? Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, just quickly, you mentioned that in 2012, that's when we located the disease in Minnesota. What was the testing like across the entire state prior to 2012 looking for CWD?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, it was 2016. And I can, if you allow me, I can go through our progression of testing over the years. We've done, to date, we've done about 60,000 samples. Prior to, in the three-year period, 2002 to 2004, we did about 28,000 samples across the state. But I have a bunch of information on that. If you don't mind, I can go through that.
It's in the program in front of us. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, just following up a little bit on Representative Wagenius's line of questions. I'm looking at the handout and the captive facilities. There's some that both have been depopulated and others that haven't. Is there anything informing us research-wise from these facilities about the spread of the disease?
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I'll defer to the Board of Animal Health on what happens inside the facilities. I'll go through what we're doing outside the facility, but you know, DNR is responsible for wild deer outside the fence. The Board of Animal Health has animals inside the fence.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that nuance. I'm a science guy. I'm looking at the research. There has to be something inside the facilities that would help inform the questions that Representative Guinness was asking. It just seems to me, transmission-wise. That's my only point. And if you can't speak to it, so be it. But we should, in this day and age, be able to talk about science as scientists. So thank you.
How do we proceed in through the Representative Figgin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Dr. Cornicelli, I obviously have been involved in this issue, and I quite frankly appreciate the work that's been done between the DNR and the Board of Animal Health when we had a meeting last year with now Commissioner Sarah Stroman and Board of Animal Health. I think that we made some strides in the right direction, and that was after the Legislative Auditor's Report came out. I am concerned, though, about your statement that Board of Animal Health has jurisdiction over inside the fence, and you have it outside. When I read the statutes 35.155, it's clear to me that the DNR does have some jurisdiction inside the fence. Can you clarify for me, please?
Dr. Corsell.
And maybe, Mr. Chair, if I may, please.
Yep.
And maybe if that's becoming a part of your memorandum of understanding that now Commissioner Stroman talked about at the round table last week, that she hoped to have that signed sometime within the next couple of weeks with the Board of Animal Health. Help me out.
Dr. Corey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, correct. DNR has some authority. It's they're mainly related to when reasonable suspicion of a violation has occurred. We have authority if there's wild animals inside the facility or if on escapes. We have pretty clear authority. But most of our authorities, I believe, are related to when there's a presumption or reason to believe a violation has occurred. We don't have general authorities to do inspections, to look at inventories. We can request inventories by statute, but we tend not to have authority just to go into facilities and do the work of the board. And we work very closely with the board, especially, and as you indicated, and the commissioner indicated, we're working on a memorandum of understanding with the board, and it's pretty close to done, and kind of keep sharing our response. We have an escape servant protocol that we work through. We have a data sharing agreement that's been signed. So we're working very closely on the board and the aspects of farm served regulation for which we share and can help.
Representative Fabian. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for the line of questioning, but just that there's many questions. One of the things that I asked Commissioner Landwehr about last year, and you mentioned it about the reasonable suspicion, and I asked staff before, what is the definition of reasonable suspicion? And to the best of my knowledge, there's really no legal definition of reasonable suspicion, which I think opens the door quite a bit, and maybe we can get some clarification on that during this legislative session. So thank you.
And Representative Fabian, I think if my memory serves me correct, we actually passed out of this committee a bipartisan provision to clarify that authority, and then somewhere later in the dark of night, it disappeared. So perhaps we can work on clarifying that again. Dr. Cornicelli, if you could proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. But with all of that, what we're trying to do is avoid the situation that you see on this slide. We're trying to not be like Wisconsin. I think, you know, we can talk at length as to when we'll get there, if we'll get there, but, you know, Wisconsin has seen counties where prevalence has stayed pretty low for a while, then all of a sudden it goes up. And it's a pretty standard epi curve for this disease, that the longer it persists in the environment, the greater likelihood an animal is going to become infected, and the greater likelihood the percentage of animals of the population becomes infected. And this is Iowa County, Wisconsin, which is kind of their ground zero, but this is really 15 years of data, and this is what we're trying to avoid with our response, because we will look like this. So to address Representative Heinzman's comments, our surveillance started back in 2002, and it was related to the discovery of the disease in wild deer in Wisconsin kind of at the end of 2001, early 2002, and then the positive elk farm in Aitken in August of 2002. So being newcomers to the disease, like most of the upper Midwestern states, Wisconsin was first, we rolled out a three-year statewide surveillance program. We used a statistical design using probability of infection if it was existed in a certain percent of the population. And over the course of 3 years, we tested 28,000 deer. All hunter harvested, all through check stations, kind of the same way we've done this work for a long time. We found no positive deer in those 3 years of surveillance, and since that time, across the state, we've collected 60,000 samples. So we've done a lot of testing in the state dating back 16 plus years. So in 2005,
Just a second, Dr. Carso, and how was that paid for?
Say again, I didn't hear a question.
How was that paid for?
Oh, we'll get to that. That was primarily paid for Game and Fish funds. Everybody wants to skip to the end. Kidding. So in 2005, we switched to what we call a risk-based surveillance program. We realized we didn't have the money to do this level of surveillance across the state. In 2003, I think in 2004, we spent at the time $1.2 or $1.3 million on surveillance. We just don't have the revenues to do that every year. And it's probably not very efficient, right, because you're looking at risk. Where does risk occur? So we look at risk in three ways. You know, deer that are suspect, animals that show up that are symptomatic to the disease. We test 100 or so plus a year of those. We look at new infections in adjacent states, and Iowa and Wisconsin are very good examples of that. That's risk to us. We also look at the association of cervid farms with our surveillance program. To date, there have been 8 of those. There's 3 ongoing right now. So we really look at surveillance as a function of what risk do we have out there and how that risk changes. So I'm not going to talk about, we'd be here for 2 hours if I talked about everything, so I'm going to skip ahead to 2016. We found CWD in the captive elk farm in Pine Island in 2009. We found a deposit in a deer in 2010, did 3 years of surveillance, didn't find anything, moved on from there. The disease was found in Alamakee County, Iowa, northeast Iowa in 2014, so we did surveillance in Houston and Fillmore counties, didn't find anything. We took 2015 off. And in 2016, we decided to go back and do surveillance. With Iowa, with Wisconsin, we decided, let's go back to the southeast and Pine Island to go back and revisit that area. So we sampled deer in the southeast in 2016 as kind of where's our risk occur. And lo and behold, as a lot of members have seen, in early November 2016, across a very broad area of what we call Zone 3, we found the disease in right north and east of Preston, found 3 cases. So in December, we created our disease management zone, which still exists today. We held a special hunt. We found a few more positives right there in Preston. This speaks to your question about where is the disease located. And in January and March, we had landowner shooting permits and USDA culling, and lo and behold, we found a few more positives around Preston. So we're kind of developing this pattern. So from November 2016 to March 2017, we tested about 4,000 plus deer and found 11 positives, all fairly close together. So that's kind of how we got to where we are. In 2017, 2018, it changed a little bit. The disease was found on a cervid farm in Crow Wing County and then also a trace farm in Meeker County. So we did surveillance around those facilities to see if the disease was present in wild deer. And, again, we do that for a period of 3 years because that's, again, the incubation period of the disease. We also implemented a feeding ban, which we typically do when we find the disease. One of the ways the disease spreads is from close contact among animals, so we ban recreational feeding in disease areas. We also, we looked at carcass stuff, so we banned. We've been operating for a long time under the Board of Animal Health statutes that carcasses from endemic areas.
Beckerfit.
Sorry, I wasn't looking. I apologize.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know you're going to get to some of the money stuff the numbers overall later, but I think while this map is in front of us, I wanted to ask. So if we go back to, like, page 3, there's a map of the United States that has the red dots where there is current CWD and captive facilities. And so it looks like we only have one of those red dots in Minnesota, and it's where we have all these zones around Crow Wing County. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the cost per year to do the surveillance just because of that one farm with a positive CWD test.
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn. We average about $150,000 a year around each facility. It depends on the deer population, the number of samples we take. It depends on the size of our surveillance area. But a good rule of thumb is about $150,000 a year. The colors on that map, that actually the USGS puts that map together. The red dots indicate that's a positive facility that still has live animals on it. The yellow dots are depopulated facilities. The red dots means that there's no state or federal law that says if you're positive, then you must depopulate that herd. So the red dots USDA uses to indicate that the facility was identified as positive, but there's still live animals on the farm.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 3 years times $150,000, so we're looking at $450,000 out of the Game and Fish Fund to pay, you know, taxpayer money, Minnesotans' money that's going because of this deer farm. If they find another positive, like let's say this year, then does that extend it another 3 years past the original three-year period?
That's
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, that's a great question, and the answer is yes. As long as there are deer on the farm, and this farm that we're talking about has had positive deer again identified this fall. So as long as there's deer on that farm, then risk doesn't change. So our concern would be if we stop doing surveillance, we won't know. The disease may become established in the absence of our knowledge, so we'll likely be doing surveillance as long as there are deer alive on that farm. And then it'll be 3 years after the last deer is gone.
Okay. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so for those watching at home and everybody's clear, so because we don't have a deer, a law requiring them to depopulate, we're going to be on the hook for $150,000 per year for an unknown, unspecified amount of time. So I guess we're looking at least over $500,000 already at this point that we're looking at because of one farm. And then on top of that, I would assume if we've had more than one positive within that farm, the chances that it's persisting in the soil and in other things increases as well. So so all these folks who hunt around these areas are also, their rights are being put at risk because of that. And I guess I was going to ask this later, but I could ask it now. Assistant Commissioner Meyer, maybe you would be the one to better speak to this, but as we've been looking at this issue, you know, for a decade now, has the DNR taken into account the potential legal liabilities infringing upon our rights to hunt in those areas? And, you know, this map is awfully close to the Leech Lake area and some of our ceded territory and some of the treaty areas. And I'm just wondering if there's been any looking into what the liability is to the DNR and thus the state if this continues to persist and we're putting the usufructuary rights to hunt as well as our Minnesotan constitutional right to hunt, if those liabilities have been taken into account as well.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Becker-Finn, no, we have not done any research on that to date. Obviously, depending on the future of the disease and the transmission in the industry, that is something we may have to take into consideration.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Following up on Representative Becker-Finn, I don't think it's something to take into consideration in the future. it seems like here now we need to determine the liability, like now, because the further we get out, the greater the liability grows. So I think that was an excellent question. And it does seem that that's a report back to this committee that we should have within weeks to know what that liability is, because as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, these facilities cannot get insurance. So if they can't get insurance, we can't even go after a facility that may be just a shell, and so it then comes to our taxpayers. Correct me if I'm wrong there.
Commissioner Meyer or Dr. Cornicelli?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, I am not familiar with the requirements of these facilities through the board, or if they have, or the ability to obtain insurance. This is a question that we will go back and discuss with our general counsel, and perhaps the committee counsel as well could do a little research on whether or not there would be a claim or a liability claim on those issues.
On the slide in front of us, it has the implemented feeding ban and the banning of all carcasses. How does the DNR enforce that? I mean, is it complaint-driven? Are those COs that are doing surveillance on feeding bans? If somebody puts a salt block out in one of the zones, and again, how is that paid for? Is it tracked as enforcing the feeding ban, or is it just a normal day on the job for the CO?
Mr. Chair, members, and I do have Colonel Smith in the audience if we would care for more detailed information. Most of it is complaint-driven, just like our baiting. When people are out hunting on land or they see people baiting, we often get calls on that. We investigate and then enforce wherever possible. So, again, it's complaint-driven, often neighbors turning in neighbors or people stumbling upon things as they're out there. The challenge we have in these areas, and Dr. Cornicelli has a slide that shows this, there's very little public land. Most of the land, as you well know, Mr. Chairman, is held in private. So the ability to see that, obviously if something's visible from the air and we're in the air, we will document that and follow up. But many of these issues are happening in the middle of people's private woods that we do not have access to. And that's an important consideration as we move forward in trying to combat the disease in these areas, is getting the cooperation of the local units of government, the cities and the counties, to be able to depopulate and cull the animals on their land as well, since we just don't have the access to, say, the Chippewa National Forest, for example, or places that are outstate with large blocks of public land.
So as we, let's say we extend the feeding ban, I'm using we here, speaking for the state, or if we had to say we're not going to distribute carcass remains on the landscape, and you have to enforce that, so we're going to have additional costs beyond the costs that we've been talking about the last few years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely correct. Then the documents that I have are costs on CWD surveillance are only the Division of Fish and Wildlife costs. So it's the testing, it's our staff time there. We are investing substantial amount of enforcement dollars to do investigatory work, not only on carcass importation, but also on processors of wild game. And that equates to loss of boots on the ground, for lack of a better term, from our enforcement division. And we're pulling together kind of an estimate of those costs right now to submit to the committee.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, and I don't know if the DNR can answer this or not, is when you've done sampling of deer, have you looked at any of the deer that have been roadkill? And also, do you know how roadkill in those areas is handled?
Dr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, we do some roadkill surveillance. We don't do a ton. In our CWD zone, we'll do it opportunistically. You know, we know we have the disease. We don't have, outside of our hunting seasons and our surveillance seasons, we don't have a lot of staff real close to there, so we don't tend to do a year-round roadkill surveillance, but we do it opportunistically as folks are in the area. We, if you look on our website, we do have an opportunistic table where we do, you know, when we can, we do. Most of our benefit is yielded by hunter harvested deer, and to lesser extent, landowner shooting permits and culling.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions come up to mind is typically if there is a carcass from a deer that's got chronic wasting disease, what is the best way to dispose of that carcass to prevent spread?
Dr. Bernstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, there's three acceptable methods of disposal. One is regular household trash that goes to a lined landfill. The other is high-temperature incineration, which most people can't do. And the other is alkaline digestion. And we do that. University of Minnesota has an alkaline digester. So whenever we get a CWD-positive animal, we make every attempt to retrieve both the carcass, and if the hunter chooses to not keep the meat, we take the meat as well. And that goes to the University of Minnesota for digestion. So that's why we talk a lot about proper carcass handling, both inside the disease zone and outside. And when we talk about risk in this slide, what we don't want to do is have someone take a positive carcass from Fillmore County or Wisconsin, dump it on the back 40, then start a disease event somewhere else. And that's why you see these rules that we've instituted relating to carcass import, relating to carcass export out of our disease zone, and then the outreach that we're doing, mailing letters and sending emails to Minnesota hunters out of state. We're on our third year of corresponding with taxidermists and venison and meat processors about the importance of not taking in out-of-state animals and proper disposal of carcasses. So that's another piece of risk that we're trying to manage, and a lot of that's done through as Mr. Meyer and the chair is outreach with enforcement and then our wildlife staff as well.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It kind of brings into question is the way that MnDOT handles the carcass, dead carcass. If they were infected, are there methods that they have in taking care of that carcass acceptable, or are they doing it the right way, or how do you folks coordinate back and forth with that department?
Dr. Grinsell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, it's my understanding, I'm not going to get this perfectly correct, but I believe a lot of those deer go to landfills. They get picked up by contractors in their landfill, which would be an acceptable method of disposal. But I'm not familiar with exact, because every county is a little bit different. You know, some counties contract with individuals. Some counties do the pickup themselves. MnDOT does some. So it's kind of all over the board who does what and where. But we could certainly check into that. But I think a lot of those carcasses just go to the landfill.
If we've got about a half an hour left, so if we could maybe get through some more of the slides.
Very good. So our surveillance around the facilities, we're in year two. If the map on the right is the Crow Wing County facility, we decided to do our surveillance in both cases more broadly than just around the facility because we haven't done a lot of surveillance in this area since, you know, in probably a decade. So we also used it as an opportunity to look at the surrounding area, not just around the facility. In and around the Crow Wing County farm, we've tested almost 9,000 deer in the last 2 years and not found a positive. In Meeker County, it's been almost 3,000 deer. The differences are the populations in Meeker County are much lower than they are in Crow Wing County. So it's a function of deer availability, not effort. So we've done a lot of surveillance, and thankfully we've not found anything in the wild. And as Representative Becker Finn alluded to, because the Crow Wing facility still has deer, we'll be doing facility around that surveillance around that facility. Jumping forward to the southeast, we've done about 12,500 deer in the last 3 years. A lot of that's mandatory over opening weekend or mandatory throughout the season in our disease zone. And this is our disease area. 2016, Fillmore County, 2017, the captive facility in Winona County, and then 2018, end of November, early December, the wild deer in Houston County. So we've done a lot of surveillance in both Minnesota and specifically southeast Minnesota over the last 15 or 16 years. So of the 24,000 deer we've tested over the last three deer hunting seasons, we have the slide as of 5 o'clock last night is wrong. It's 35 positives. There was a found dead deer near Preston that's presumptive positive now. Most of our positives are centered around Preston. The radiating out from that center are all adult males. There's one female about 5 miles north of Preston, but the rest of them are adult males that are adult or yearling males that are kind of spreading out from that center. And that speaks to the rate of infection of spread. So what are we doing? We keep doing mandatory surveillance. We're going to keep that up as long as we can. We have the carcass export restrictions, and the compliance with that is very good. We've provided a quartering station through Bluffland Whitetails Association, a dumpster and a refrigerated trailer in Preston all season for folks who don't have a way to hold the carcass in the zone, don't have a way to handle their carcass. They can go to Preston, take care of everything. This gets used a lot. It's been very popular with our hunters, very popular. We had two late season hunts. We decided that with our USDA culling and the late season hunts and everything else that was going on, we still want to interact with landowners and give them an opportunity, but the timing was short. So we decided to send a permit to all landowners in the area that had 20 acres or more. It was 3,500 permits. This slide as of last night is wrong too. It's about 350 samples, give or take. Last weekend they did pretty well. So it went for mailing 3,500 permits cold. It actually went pretty well. So we'll see what we do next year. We're partnering with Bluffland Whitetails on what we call a Share the Harvest program. So if a landowner or when USDA starts culling, if the people don't want the deer, we have a mechanism to donate not detected animals out to the local community. So that's a really popular program. We're thankful for that. The culling is on hold partly due to the federal shutdown, but also due to the mild weather we're having down there. Our point person with the USDA who does the landowner permissions is on furlough, so we're working on some private land parcels we already have permission for and some of the DNR-owned lands, and as soon as the weather turns, we'll probably start removing deer. We're doing a lot of survey work with our hunters and landowners. We use a lot of social science research to inform our management decisions. We're also updating our CWD response plan to include some sections on control zones, regulatory alternatives, incentives, and we're going to put that out for public input and comment, hopefully in the near future. One interesting piece of info, and it's kind of those of you who...
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you have on here that you have social science surveys of hunters and landowners in the Southeast. I was just wondering, what are some of the efforts for the hunters that are not in Southeast Minnesota but are throughout the metro and other parts of the state, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a great question. We know that a lot of our hunters come from the metro. So when you buy a license with the DNR, the license agent asks you where you hunt most often, say 349. You might live in Hennepin County, but you hunt 349. So you'd be in that survey pool. Right now we're focusing our work in the Southeast because of our disease concerns, but we're also going to be doing another round of our deer goal setting project where we'll be doing surveys of hunters and landowners related to deer population goals, and I'm sure there'll be some disease questions on that survey. So basically, our strata are drawn from the people who say they hunt those permit areas. It's irrespective of where they live. Now, landowners are different because we use the landowner parcel data and then select our sample based on where you live. So we're catching, and then we don't survey both. So we weed out, you get one or the other. So we're really trying to use our survey work to help inform those decisions using the folks that live and hunt in those communities.
Perfectly.
And so another point that you have on here is the quartering station, the dumpsters, and the trailer. I was just curious, do you have any cost to the public for using that, or is that free and open to the public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, that's a really good question. No, there is no cost to the hunter. DNR pays for the – it's on county land. It's a cost from the sheriff's office in Preston, so it's on county land, I think. We pay for the refrigerated trailer, the DNR does, and we pay for the dumpster. Bluffland Whitetails is built and maintains the quartering shed, but there's no cost. And we even have some tables in the quartering shed. We have some lifts for people to lift the deer, to skin deer, and all of that's provided as free of charge to people. What we really want to do is not move disease out of the area and at the same time make it as convenient as we can on our hunters so they don't have to stress about how am I going to comply with this regulation. Well, go to Preston. We'll take care of you. So that's how we've approached it. There's no cost to the hunter.
Proceed.
Okay, thank you. Interesting little piece of data, as you'd expect, deer move along riparian corridors, right? They move along habitat. So we're seeing these positive males along rivers and streams. And this makes perfect sense. As males move across the landscape, they use habitat to do that. We're picking them up as positives in our harvest. So kind of to wrap it up, I'll go quick. Expenditures. Since 2002, we've spent about $8.4 million on disease CWD surveillance. The last 6 years, that's been entirely paid for out of the Game and Fish Fund, so license fees. So of all of our spending over the last 16, 17 years, it's about $7.2 million of Game and Fish Fund spending. License sales, we know we're seeing a decline in license sales nationally and in Minnesota, just naturally as hunters age. However, we're seeing steeper declines in the southeast and more specifically around our disease management area. We don't have a ton of data. Some of this will be borne out by the survey work we're doing with risk perceptions, but we're losing hunters in our disease area at higher rates than we're losing them around the rest of the state. So there may very well be a disease effect on participation in the absence of human health concerns. As you know, 500,000 deer hunters are just under. They contribute at least $500 million to the state's economy. As I noted before, it's been said, we'll spend about $1.3 million this year, not including enforcement on our CWD survey response. It's expensive. Like I said, around facilities, about $150,000 a year, and we do that for 3 years, assuming that the it's been depopulated. And, again, that cost has been borne by folks who buy licenses. We do think that, you know, we're really concerned about the long-term effect on deer populations, but we're also concerned about the long-term effects on hunter behavior and local economies. When deer hunters leave, that has a big impact locally. And, again, I think we're losing hunters at a higher rate than we're seeing in other parts of the state. We're doing a pretty neat little deer movement study, looking in addition to where we pick up positives, but how do these animals move across the landscape? It's partially funded by LCCMR. We thank them for that. And that'll help us inform our disease zone. We're seeing movements of deer, like you'd expect across the landscape. Young deer move quite a long distance. Older deer move around quite a lot as well. So that's going to help us define our risk. And we'll be capturing deer again in the next three weeks or so, depending on whether to augment our sample size as part of the study. So we're using the animals themselves to help inform what our zone should look like. And then what I found real interesting is, you know, we hear a lot. I've been doing deer stuff most of my adult life, and you always hear, you know, these are my deer. I planted food plot to keep the deer on my property, and I want to see my deer. Well, here's one deer that we caught last March. This animal was caught just southwest of Houston and then moved further south than that. It was a juvenile male. He's visited 82 separate parcels over the course of the last 6 or 7 months. So we view these animals as all our deer. They're not just one person's, because they're using multiple parcels over a broad landscape. So one animal, 82 parcels in about 6 months. So they really do move a lot. You know, as Commissioner Meyer said, one of our challenges, obviously, is public versus private land. If you look at the white on this map, this is our disease zone. That's private land. You look at the green and brown, that's public land. Most of our disease deer have been found on private land. So we can change regulations. We can liberalize bag limits. We can give away free licenses. But if we don't have access to where these infected deer reside, then that makes it challenging for us. And that's what we're working with USDA and Todd Froberg, our landowner assistance specialist, and others, trying to gain access to these parcels because of our concern over long-term disease spread, as you talked about, Representative. So final slide. You know, we have a lot of challenges. I mean, there's no sugarcoating that. Land access, it's mostly private. We're having some difficulty on some non-DNR state lands and county lands and city lands. We're working through some of that. As scientists, it's easy for me to explain science, relatively easy compared to explaining emotions. You know, we deal with an emotional issue of long-term deer health. How is it affecting my deer hunting? What are you doing to my deer? So we have a really hard time articulating the long-term implications of this disease because we can't see it right now, and that's difficult for us to do. The funding piece, you know, our response is really expensive, and hunters have been bearing that. There's a narrow window to be successful. We know that. We may not be there in Preston anymore, but we can certainly affect those areas around Preston. And then the open-ended question that I'll leave you with is deer move all over the landscape. How big should the zone be? And that's where the data helps inform those decisions because we don't take lightly changing our zone size because the bigger we go, the more people it affects, and that we get that. So we really want to make good decisions based on the data that we're able to collect. And that's all I had, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. As a fiscal committee, are there things that aren't being done because we're doing this? Could you maybe enlighten us on those costs?
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for that question, and I have a document prepared for you. And as that's going around, first of all, I would like to say thank you for the legislature last year for the $750,000 general fund that was in the omnibus bill. However, did not get signed into law. That would have helped reduce these impacts. So the sheet before you, and I'll just give you a second to get that around. The entire fall CWD effort represents approximately 2.5% of the section of wildlife's FTEs. We had about 11,000 hours, total staff hours. That includes overtime and compensatory hours earned, just because we have to factor that into the impact of that. About 1,700, calculated based upon about 1,700 hours of work time per year by FTE. Some of the work that wasn't getting done, habitat enhancement projects, about $400,000 reduction from that category. User facility projects on WMAs, $240,000 reduction. An internship program expansion of $70,000. Conservation easement monitoring, $40,000. Hunter walking trail development, $36,500. An urban deer disposition trial, $20,000 on that. The table on the back of this handout summarizes the costs. You can see the salaries. Game and Fish Fund, $550,000. Supplies and expenses for our testing and all the equipment that we have, $250,000 from the Game and Fish Fund and $300,000 from the Servant Health account. Our USDA contract will be paying for that, and Dr. Cornicelli outlined some of the problems we have right now. Our contract specialist at the USDA is on furlough. Luckily, I guess not luckily is the right term, but the weather's not cooperating as well, so we're still establishing sites for that work to take place. Hopefully it'll coordinate, and the federal government will get back on track to get that work done as soon as possible. And then overall, it was $1 million from the Game and Fish Fund and $300,000 from the Servant Health account, which is funded off of 50 cents of each deer license goes into that account, which has statutory uses, which include Servant Health activities and also deer feeding, emergency deer feeding at that time. Mr. Chairman, there have been a number of impacts. We are in the process of working through the governor's budget proposals and the process there. We remain hopeful that there will be something in the governor's budget, hopefully to deal with the chronic waste and disease issue that we have to deal with right now.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cornicelli, if I missed it, I apologize, but walk me through the process. So Dan Fabian's out deer hunting, shoots a deer in an area, I take it to the CWD test site. Do I get that test back immediately? I assume it has to be sent to either the U or else to Colorado. Is that correct?
Dr. Cornicelli, Representative Fabian, I could answer that question with the two examples of what I did. So during the special hunts, which there were two hunts, one before Christmas and one after, so the deer I shot there, I shot it, brought it to Preston. There were, at the DNR station, there were people lined up. There were veterinary students and DNR staff there, and they cut out the lymph nodes. And then I had to say exactly where I shot it. I had to fill out the information, and then I got a number where I could look up online when those test results came back.
I took the deer to a butcher shop. It got butchered. I brought the carcass parts back to the dumpster in Preston and put them there. And then I waited. I picked up my butcher deer and I waited for the test results, and it came back. It said pending for a very long time.
Holidays.
Because of Christmas and New Year's. So, and I kept that in the meat, I kept in the zone until I got a no detect. And then I brought that home. I had a freezer at my farm. So that was during the special hunt. This weekend, as a landowner, there were no staff. The staff were not at the Preston location. So what I did there is I've been working with other landowners, particularly Amish down there, where they put a head box because they weren't going to be bugging their deer up to Preston after they shot it at night. So they had a head box. So cut the head off the deer and put the head into the head box that then the DNR staff would come around each day and pick that up, even on a Sunday. So on a Sunday, I dropped off the head box, took the deer to the butcher shop, and right now it's sitting in the freezer at the butcher shop. I will have to pick that up, bring the carcass parts back to the dumpster, and then wait until I get a pending. The pending goes either to a no detector or not. If it comes back detected, I will take that meat that I paid for butchering and I will put it in the dumpster along with the carcass parts. Representative Fabian.
Okay, I understand that. So my question was going to be, so if I've done whatever I do to process the deer and then I go home and then 2 weeks later or whatever, it shows up online that my deer was CWD positive, okay, what responsibility do I have at that point? For the carcass and the brain and the spinal cord and that sort of stuff.
Dr. Corso.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's a good question. You won't, if you shoot a CWD positive deer, you will not learn from the internet. You'll get a call from us. Our results typically come in late in the day, typically on Friday, because most of our samples go out on Monday. But the first thing we do is call the hunter so they know that it's presumptive positive. So there's two tests that are done. There's a screening ELISA, which our results are returned in 3 business days, and then confirmatory test is the immunohistochemistry you've probably heard of, and that tissue then needs to be fixed, stained, thin section, and that takes about another week. So we'll give you, the hunter, notification that, hey, Representative Fabian, you have a presumptive CWD positive deer. You'll get results in about a week. Hold on to the meat. You know, we recommend you don't consume it per the guidelines. We'll call you one way or the other as soon as we know. Let Representative Fabian, your deer is now confirmed with CWD. Can we get the carcass? And actually, we'll try and pick up the carcass when it's presumptive. But we'll try and retrieve the carcass and also the meat, and then we'll dispose of it at the University of Minnesota at the digester, and we'll come to you to come get it. We haven't had a lot of positives, but most have ended up in the Preston dumpster, and that goes to the line landfill. So that's an acceptable disposal method. But Will, the most recent one in Houston County, we went to the person's property where they had deposited the carcass and picked it up and, you know, grabbed it, threw it in the truck, took it up to the digester. So we're trying to keep these deer off the landscape.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that and the line landfill and all that. But, I mean, are there critters inside the, I mean, there's bald eagles and ravens and whatnot that come in here and eat these things too. Is there something else we could be doing instead?
Dr. Corso.
Coyotes, fox?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, there's not been a lot of work done on consumption of animals at landfills and then prion exposure elsewhere.
Yeah.
But like I said, we do the best we can to retrieve the carcasses that we can, knowing that, you know, we use one of the three acceptable methods. Our personal preference is get the carcass and digest it, because then it's gone. So we do the best that we can. And we've actually dumpster dived on a couple of carcasses that have come back and gone into that. Someone goes into the dumpster and peels it out to digest. So we've done, yeah, I know, it's great. We've done that too.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then real quickly, the one slide that you have dating back to 2002 with the $7.2 million that's being taken from the Game and Fish Fund to pay for this, how many total dollars have been in the Game and Fish Fund since 2002?
Dr. Grinsell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that is not a question I can answer, but we can certainly get that number.
Thank you. I'll, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Quinicelli, I was just wondering, is there a science behind the risk of, you know, the example that Representative Hansen has said, the butcher going through and processing the meat, and if it was a positive, I'm not sure in this case, is there a risk for the butcher and the other customers that the butchers are going to have coming in after having processed that?
Dear. Dr. Quinicelli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, venison processing is always a question, you know, who mixes? Some processors mix meat, some just do whole muscle cuts, they don't mix meat. Almost all of them mix sausage. There's at least one processor in Wisconsin that quit doing venison because they didn't want to mix, didn't want it. The only way they could get by making sausage was to mix it, and they didn't feel comfortable doing that anymore. So I think we have to measure that risk against probability of disease, and I think you're seeing, the one processor that's in our CWD zone, Representative Hansen may know this better, but if I'm not mistaken, they actually keep the deer in the cooler until the test comes back not detected. So they'll hold it, and when the test comes back, then they'll process the deer for that person. The same thing when we had CWD in Pine Island, 2011, the processor that was in that zone did exactly that. He would call me just about every day with a list of MDNR numbers. That was pre-putting it on the online. So I'd get a call every day, and I'd say, okay, these three are done, these four aren't done, and then he would go ahead and process them once the test came back. So I think the general awareness of individuals as they're exposed to the disease, they get better at handling carcasses. But the processors that we've worked with within our disease zone have been quite excellent.
President Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do the DNR provide general guidelines for processors, or is it more just, like you mentioned, general awareness about the issues?
Dr. Grinsell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, we have a bunch of fact sheets on the disease in general. We don't necessarily send specific guidelines to processors. DNR doesn't regulate them. We do send them information about CWD, about the carcass import restrictions. Most of them, I think most of them know by now because they've been exposed to CWD in other states and in this state and other, like bovine TB and other just general food safety protocols. So I think most of them are aware, and we do some outreach in the form of what you can and can't do. But I would defer to MDA as to what they do for handling meat in general per the USDA, you know, inspection guidelines and everything else that goes along with that.
We've got about 7 minutes. Representative Becker Finn, then Representative Wagenius, then Representative Lewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a related and maybe gross path of questioning, but was thinking about, so typically we've talked about the spread is animal to animal through saliva, feces, urine. Wondering what you know about the risks with blood. And then as I was listening to Chair Hansen's scenario, you know, typically you gut it in the field. So then what about that what about that gut pile and the, you know, and the transmission, possible transmission in that way as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative right. Becker Finn. Yes, we recognize that that eviscerated remains are going to be on the landscape, and there's not a ton we can do about it. There's been some work with bovine TB in Michigan and other places looking at dead end hosts. You know, coyotes eat those carcasses; they can cycle prions, but there's really no evidence to show that they're contributing to disease spread. That environmental piece really becomes important when infection rates are high. When you have a lot of animals on the landscape, that are, look at the 50% prevalence in some parts of Wisconsin. There's a lot of animals that are shedding prions on a good chunk of the landscape. We're dealing with individuals that are infected, and while there's probably some risk, it's not nearly as amplified as if a lot of animals were infected. And that's, again, our point with not getting to that stage, because then you start thinking about other sources of risk. There was a paper published from Wisconsin looking at natural and artificial mineral licks where they found prions at those mineral sites. So, you know, you get enough animals that are spreading, you know, the agent around where then it really becomes important. At these low rates that we're seeing, it's probably not detectable.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the low rates we're seeing thus far, also just wanted to thank you for the terminology of eviscerated remains. I'll keep that one in mind in the future, so thank you.
Representative Borgenius.
Thank you. I'm thinking about the fact that we don't know how long these prions last, and that we're putting the carcasses in a landfill, and the carcasses will obviously decompose fairly rapidly. These lined landfills have leachate collection systems. Do you know where the leachate's going?
Dr. Granatelli or Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Borgenius, depending on the facility, that leachate will be collected, sometimes used as on the daily cover or sometimes treated. So we can certainly look at that, and depending on the facilities. Every facility is a little bit different, as you know. So but it is a good question to raise. And the carcass would be covered with daily cover every day. So Representative Fabian's question about eagles and critters. Maybe up in Kitson County, there's a few more of those kinds of critters running around the landfills. But down in most of these areas, they're protected facilities. But it is something we need to take a closer look at, and maybe as a policy discussion, talk about what is the best management practices for these carcasses.
You done? Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably not a question we've got time to answer, and it probably going to take a little bit of luck. But what I'm really a little bit concerned about here is I've heard a lot about monitoring, but I haven't heard very much about really what specifically you're doing to squeeze this disease down and eliminate it. And so I would ask that you take a look at another presentation that talks about exactly what you do in an area where you find a positive deer. And the reason I ask that is the elk farm that you mentioned from a number of years ago was 3 miles from my house. And one positive elk inside the facility discovered through the process that the elk ranchers use if they have a sick animal. As I remember the scenario, and it's a while back, and that's why I would like you to go back and look at that scenario. We did an extreme deer culling around that farm in the spring and summer because we needed answers as to how we were going to manage the deer that fall for that season. And when I say extreme, we created pretty close to a vacuum around that farm for a while. It filled in very quickly. So, Ed, you're a veteran of the tuberculosis issue in the Northeast, as I am. The first time I met you. but I think there's a lot of area to be looked at as to exactly how we respond, how quickly we respond, and there's a real tension between what a portion of society would like to do and what you really have to do to get your hands around this disease. Because I watched 1,000 head of cattle and a young family just gone. That's what you got to do. And it's something we need to probably talk about offline and bring this back to the committee. Let the public know what it really takes to get a hold of a disease like this, because it's not pretty, and I don't think we can hide it, and we need to get focused on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, yes, I was going to mention bovine TB. We've shared many a meeting space. You know, a lot of the responses are the same, but they're a little bit different. As you know, and Representative Fabian knows, about half of the land is public in the Northwest, and we were able to affect deer densities because we had access to public land. Severe winters, we could bait deer and shoot them. So the response was a lot of the same methods, but successfulness was different because of the landscape. We're dealing with private land here, and we've hired a landowner assistance specialist whose job is to basically hearts and minds work on landowners and stress the importance of the disease. And we rely on other folks who are working closely with Bluffland Whitetails and MDHA and other groups and individuals trying to show people how important this is over the long term. But The reality is we can only do so much from the regulatory perspective, and we need to get access to the areas where positive deer exist, and that's our success. And that's why we've been really focusing in those areas. That's why we hired a person specifically to do that. And it's a, and as you know, relationships are slow to build. And any help that we can get to break down those barriers we'll take, because I agree with you 100%. You know, it goes right back to what we all learned in bovine TB.
I appreciate that, because we really had some really tough discussions with farm families that literally lost their existence. They were out of the business permanently. And these are kids that lost their 4-H animals and everything else. So we really got to take a look at that, because, yeah, there has to be a mindset change and understand how important it is to eliminating this disease. To, sad to say, you're going to have to really eliminate a lot of deer in the interest of doing this, because it's lucky with cattle, because we got a pen around them, we count them, we know them, we've got. And frankly, they all go down. So we can get response real quick on eliminating an area. It's really tough with obviously with deer. So yeah, I'm ready to help you with that as much as we can, because that is a really a tall one to whip. And that's the social, cultural issues that go around with what we do with wildlife.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, I'll close that with, you're exactly right, and think about how closely we work with Board of Animal Health, with MDA, with the Cattlemen's Association, the Deer Hunters Association. You know, it was tough, and we came out okay on the other side, but those were not fun meetings, as you well know. But we banded together and we dealt with it, and those are the challenges that we face, because people have different opinions on how we should proceed. There's people who think we should do nothing, which we think is the wrong thing to do. So we're working towards that end.
This is the first meeting of the Environment Finance Committee, not the last. For those of you that are new to the committee, hearing about eviscerated remains and gut piles, you probably will hear about those again as we go forward. But I know there's a number of folks that are interested in this issue. We had this today because this is our introductory meeting. We're trying to stay in the areas that are in the jurisdiction of this committee. I think, you know, just the conversation we've had, you've also touched on PCA, MDA, Board of Animal Health, and I think that you'll see, as this goes on, further hearings about this. I think there will be some bills coming. We'd ask that the administration work with the other agencies, so to bring forward some, I mean, these questions about landfills and waste disposal, I think, are somewhat new. And the issues with inspection for food processing, I thought, also is somewhat new. So I would ask that you work together, you know, and I think we're going to have probably several hearings about this, because the potential here is very large for impacts not only on the budget, on your budget, but the people of Minnesota. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.